Keith Pellon. Welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Throughout Asia, journalists are under attack. A number of journalists have been threatened, harassed, and even killed for doing their jobs. June Worthington is the acting director of the International Federation of Journalists Asia Pacific office. She speaks next to Richard Adie.
With a lot of the killings in Pakistan, you've got our media that's under a horrendous amount of attack. We've had a lot of journalists targeted in Balochistan in particular, where you've just a few months ago we had assassins go in and shoot three media workers in their office. It's sadly not uncommon that journalists are targeted for their work, and as to the detail of what they're writing on, it's usually something that someone doesn't want to have written, but the details are sketchy always.
Indeed. And sadly, it's not uncommon for journalists to be threatened for what they write or how they cover things. Do we know if any threats were made in this case?
I believe there were threats in this case. We're still trying to get information from Pakistan on this case. You know, threats often precede killings. That is the reality. You know, this is the reason we say threats must be taken seriously. In most cases, a death will follow a threat. So governments and police must act on threats as a serious attack on a journalist, be it by text message, verbal, whatever way it comes.
Well, Pakistan has proven to be, unfortunately, one of the deadliest countries in which to be a journalist. And Hamid Mir, who's a very famous journalist in Pakistan, he survived an assassination attempt beforehand. Six bullets hit him. And we've spoken about him before on the media report. He's been threatened again this week.
Yeah, and it really comes as no surprise. I mean, Hamid Mir is a brave journalist and he's admired greatly, not only in his own country, but around the world. He's fearless. And it's for this reason he has found himself up against numerous threats and attacks. I was actually in Pakistan the week before the attempt was made on his life.
So. Do you know, and the thing that it was, or what people think, is he wrote in his weekly column that Pakistan should officially apologise for Bangladesh for atrocities committed in 1971, when Bangladesh seceded from Pakistan. So this is something that is 40-odd years ago.
Yeah, I mean, this is the nature of the chaos, if you like, in Pakistan. Journalists are absolutely reviled. If they say something that absolutely shames or threatens the status quo in the country, there they go, they're under attack. And Hamid Mir, you know, he has stood up against this, he continues to stand up against this.
The concern, of course, is that because he's continued to speak out and write what he thinks is right, that this is going to end one way.
I fear for that, and I think there's a lot of his supporters are gravely fearful for that. So we are keeping a close watch on his well-being and safety because, you know, it's important that people like Hamid Mir exist because they are fearless, because they are challenging state agencies in Hamid Mir's case. But when you have a lawlessness, as you see in Pakistan, you know, you can't be guaranteed that you will survive.
An impunity. Well, if we move to Southeast Asia, to Myanmar, which has been hosting ASEAN this week. Of course, there's been, between APEC and the G20, there's been developments in the killing of a journalist. I think it's Pa Gui.
Yeah, Pa Gui, I think. But don't hold me to that. This is an absolutely tragic case, the first killing of a journalist in Myanmar in 7 years. And after massive reforms in the country that has seen the media open up, what we've witnessed over this year has been a steady decline in those press freedoms and then to the situation where we have a freelance journalist who's well known both nationally and internationally for his work.
Now, I understand that what happened was, this is last month, he was killed. He was photographing a clash between the military and a rebel group in the state of Mon, and then he was detained by the military after that, and then later on it was sort of announced, well, he's dead.
Yeah, allegedly detained for questioning. I mean, of course, the news of his detainment and subsequent killing was actually withheld by the military for 3 weeks, at which time we finally learned that he'd actually died allegedly trying to escape because he'd taken a gun. I mean, these are, of course, claims by the military that we would challenge, because obviously what's happened in the weeks since, we've seen the body exhumed from the temporary grave that was created for him. The injuries that were visible on his body were not, they certainly suggest torture.
They are consistent with torture. Mm-hmm. It is a hopeful sign in a way, in that, you know, it's not that long ago that this would never have been heard about, and B, nothing would have been done.
Yeah, it is a positive sign. I mean, I find that really, really hard to say it's a positive sign when you see the first journalist killed in Myanmar in 7 years. But the fact that you've got the president weighing in, as he did, to order the exhumation of the body, you know, he clearly is on a watch. He cares about what the world thinks of what is happening in Myanmar. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of activity in Myanmar. A lot of agencies are in there assisting this country to get on its feet, to see democracy grow. So there's a willingness there, but just how far does it go when it comes to freedom of the press is one that we're still keeping a watch on.
While I've got you, the French journalists who were detained for a while in West Papua before being released a few weeks ago, do we know what the situation is with their local fixers?
No, at this stage we don't. I'm actually going to Indonesia in a few weeks' time, where I hope to have some discussions with Jokowi. There's meetings being set up by the local Indonesians, journalists' unions and the media industry as a whole.
And you'll get to talk to the president?
We hope so, yeah. That's the plan, and that's the goal. I mean, there's a lot of hope to be optimistic on what may happen in terms of the media in West Papua under the new president.
Actually, I have to ask you about this, even though it's a very unusual one. A journalist who works for the Pekanbaru Express in Sumatra has now been arrested by the police. Do you know about this?
It's an unusual case, but not one that relates to press freedom as far as we can see. It's a straight-out crime. Unfortunately, it's a sad case, obviously, that a journalist has been involved. You know, it seems like a murder.
Allegedly robbing and killing a man and then coming back to report on the story.
Yeah. It's an unusual story. It's not one where we're weighing into at this stage. The advice we have from our Indonesian friends is that it's a straight-out crime and these things happen, sadly.
Okay, fair enough. Now, you are off to the Philippines because of an important anniversary coming up. Just remind us.
5 years ago, the world was actually absolutely shocked by the news that there'd been a mass assassination of journalists and civilians.
31, I'm thinking, something like
32 journalists. The numbers, some media organisations will quibble over the numbers. The IFJ has a strong determination on journalists being, including media workers, photojournalists, drivers. Mm-hmm. So in our interpretation of the number of media workers / journalists who died that day, 32. And there were 32 killed in a mass assassination as they travelled on a political convoy. 58 people died that day.
This is in the south, isn't it?
In the south, in Maguindanao.
Yeah. So going back there 5 years on, what are you hoping to achieve?
Well, in 5 years, nothing has happened. You've got a horrific case where 198 were named for being potentially involved in that case. 93 are still on the run. The court case has dragged on painfully, especially for the families who lost their loved ones. Not a single guilty verdict has been handed down. 3 crucial witnesses to that massacre have been killed in the time that this has dragged on. So what you have is one of the most severe cases of impunity, justice denied at this stage.
To be fair, although that's hard to say, this part of the Philippines, it's contested. It's a very fragile state. In many ways, the official state doesn't operate at all.
It's a lawless place in some respects, absolutely. But the situation was known, you know, leading up to the events of that day. And what is particularly tragic about it is that the convoy was given the all clear to travel these roads, told by the military that they were safe, and of course, what happened was that they were taken to their graves.
So this visit is about underlying what still remains to be done, essentially.
The whole world is looking to the Philippines. I mean, you've got a former journalist who leads the country who's been unable to bring justice in this particular case. But what we've seen happen, because justice has been delayed or denied, the killings of other journalists have continued. So we've got four journalists killed this year alone in the Philippines. So as long as these murders go unpunished, there is a lawlessness that has actually, you know, runs right across the Philippines, not just in Mindanao.
That was Jane Worthington, the acting director of the International Federation of Journalists for the Asia-Pacific Office, speaking to Richard Ady about journalists in Asia under attack. Now, some of you may or may not have heard of the Kingdom of Bhutan. Unlike other countries around the world that have gross domestic product, Bhutan, the Kingdom of Bhutan, has gross happiness product. Yes, I know that is very strange. Visiting the country, of course, is also very expensive. You can spend hundreds of dollars a day just for a visa. And this, of course, is a way to keep the tourist numbers to that beautiful country down. Now, since Bhutan only had television not that long ago, and radio, of course, has been around a lot longer, the internet and other new media is finally taking off in the country. Now, how about starting a newspaper? Well, we have this report from Richard Ady.
Bundy Avison used to be in women's magazines. She was the editor of Woman's Day and the editorial director of New Idea. But in the early noughties, while in Bhutan with her husband, the country was changing, moving toward democracy. And Bunty found that her expertise was needed on the country's first independent newspaper, the Bhutan Observer.
The time that they decided to launch newspapers was around the same time that newspapers were being so challenged everywhere else in the world. So it was a big call for a couple of reasons, and it's had mixed success.
Well, that's it. You said there was one newspaper run by the government. Nobody read it. So there's no culture of reading newspapers.
No, there's no culture of reading. It's an oral culture.
No culture of reading at all.
No culture of reading at all. That's changing slowly, but culturally, no. It's an oral culture where they had, there's something like 23 different languages, not dialects, but languages, and all of them are oral with no written form. And then the king decided about 30 years ago that they needed to be able to create a written form for one of these languages as part of this moving into the modern world. So while there was, the monasteries had prayer books and they had writing and reading, the mainstream people didn't write things down and they didn't read.
So in fact, isn't there a saying that if you want to keep a secret in Bhutan, write it in a book?
That's right, because no one will read it.
Okay, I can see what possessed you then.
It was a challenge, unlike any other.
Well, let's get a sense of the paper itself, so the office and the staff. Given that there's no real tradition of reading newspapers, how much training did the people who were actually putting the paper out have?
Well, they didn't have any training. Well, it varied. Some of them had gone to India and had worked on newspapers there or been trained. The newspaper that existed, the government one, had evolved over time. And the story of the government newspaper was quite an interesting one. The man who launched it, Kim Lee Dorji, came to Australia to learn to be a journalist. And he was the country's first journalist. And that was about 25, 30 years ago. And he was in the same year as Andrew Denton and Amanda Keller at Bathurst. And he was sent by the king at the time to go and learn to be a journalist, come back and start or move our government gazette towards being a newspaper. So that government gazette, Kunsul newspaper, was started by the country's first journalist that was trained in Australia. And then he trained people under him that worked on that newspaper. So there was, when I say that there was no tradition of newspapers, not amongst the mainstream, certainly the educated government people and the royal family read the newspaper, but the majority of people didn't. And so when the family that I knew decided they wanted to start a newspaper, there weren't any journalists to kind of, you know, poach or to, and they couldn't bring people in from outside.
How did they recruit?
Well, the recruiting was a lot of fun. They invited university graduates to come and explain what they would do on the newspaper. And the ones that wrote an essay in English that made the most sense about what a newspaper could be got the job. The sense of enthusiasm and this is a brave new world was brilliant.
And I suppose the other thing is that you don't know what you can't do. You're not restricted by the kind of the norms of doing a newspaper or the orthodoxies of how you do journalism.
That's right. Absolutely.
And that can be positive.
And they came up with such creative ways to do things. For example, there was no businesses to go and say buy space to sell your product. They just didn't have that kind of marketing advertising culture. So what they did is they went to Wikipedia and downloaded a list of days. You know, like there's International Tuberculosis Day, International Handwashing Day, International Talk Like a Pirate Day.
Yes.
They downloaded that list, highlighted all the ones that they thought were relevant, and then went to various NGOs and government departments to get them to sponsor information pullouts that week. So it wasn't advertising as we would recognise it. It was more public service pullouts that matched these international days.
All right. So how did it fit into this newly evolving media landscape? Because you've already mentioned there was the government paper. And I think there was another independent starting around the same time.
Yes, two of them launched at the same time, Bhutan Times and Bhutan Observer. They were greeted with a lot of enthusiasm, and it appeared to a lot of the educated class that this was a good thing to do to launch newspapers. There are currently, or last time I looked, there was a dozen newspapers. All of them are failing. There still isn't advertising. There still isn't much of a newspaper culture.
What is in them? If I pick up one of these papers, if I pick up the paper you worked at, what am I going to read about, assuming I can read that language?
You'll read very much what's going on with the Bhutanese government, with what's happening in the main city of Thimphu. It's very local news, and it's things about the roads, what the farmers are doing, the price of potatoes. Very domestic news.
It's a very agricultural country, isn't it?
So yes.
You're going to, I imagine, there's going to be a lot about agriculture.
Yes. And there's also a lot about the royal family.
I guess the royal family's at the top of the hierarchy. Is there a tradition in which you can ask hard questions of people who are kind of not at your level?
It's a very hierarchical structure socially. So that has been a challenge for them with this new media landscape, or now having journalists asking questions, because traditionally you wouldn't. Traditionally you wouldn't ask questions of a very important person or somebody who was part of the senior government or certainly the royals. You just wouldn't question them. But that's being turned on its head now that they are a democracy and now that there is an active media.
And so how do the people who are not used to being asked questions, who've spent perhaps decades not being asked questions, when somebody rolls up and asks them a question?
It's been very challenging. So some of the government ministers have refused to respond. They're in a state of everybody's learning their roles. So the journalists are learning to ask the hard questions and the ministers are learning to be accountable. And it's a bit of a dance and it's a bit of learning on both sides and in constant negotiation.
I can't ask you about Bhutan without thinking of this gross national happiness, because that is probably the thing that Bhutan's best known for, isn't it?
Yes.
Is it real?
Yeah. Look, I spent a lot of time trying to get my head around gross national happiness. This is something that comes up in conversation pretty much every part of the day.
Really?
It is so much part of their public discussion about, yes.
So at news meetings, when you're trying to work out what you're covering, it's going to come up?
Yes, repeatedly. It is how they frame all of the what they consider to be progress within their country.
You tell a story actually in your book about a reporter who actually trailing along these sorts of public meetings where everyone says how full of gross national happiness they are, he actually tests that and finds it's not that simple.
Yes. He went along because they once a year they will go right across the country and interview every single inhabitant to ask them about their level of happiness and how they're going.
And people say they're fantastically happy, don't they?
People are confronted with these important people from the capital, Thimphu. They're visiting them. They're so overwhelmed and impressed that these people have come, and they say yes to anything that they're asked. And this reporter from the Bhutan Observer saw this going on, and because he was also from a poor village, he could see exactly what was going on. So after these important men with their ledgers left, he asked the local farmers, and are you happy? And they said, well, of course not. We haven't got enough food to eat. And he was able to unpack, using his skills as a journalist and using his voice as a journalist and his platform, he was able to bring that to the fore in a way that their institutionalised structures weren't.
No, indeed. How did the story go down, though?
Beautifully. It's what they wanted. It's part of this kind of change and dynamism even the Gross National Happiness Commission themselves, who were conducting the survey, were happy that it came out. That's what they're trying to, you know, dismantle and discover.
You mentioned earlier that there's now something like 12 newspapers and they're all sort of struggling.
Yes.
What about, and also that the country is very, it's a spoken culture. Where does that leave social media, something like Facebook?
Yes. Well, this is what has been such an extraordinary change for them. So while newspapers arrived and were struggling, at the same time digital media arrived, mobile phones were phenomenally successful. There's something like 93% of households have a mobile phone.
Wow.
And they use them to do all sorts of things. They use them to stream radio. So you've got yak farmers in remote mountain areas who are completely up to date with what's happening in politics and streaming Parliament live on their mobile phones. They're a terribly politically engaged culture. But then they're also using Facebook. Facebook has been phenomenal. It's created this space where they now have all that public discussion that the King wanted to happen in the newspapers, but it just being an oral culture, the newspapers weren't so successful. Modern media, digital media, has created this space for all of that. So the Facebook pages, they use them for political activism, for culture. They use it like a virtual town square. Facebook has been, somehow it has absolutely culturally been appropriate for them. They love it.
So this change that the King instigated, it's working. And what it's doing, though, is exposing problems of if you don't have enough to eat, there's a lot of poverty in a country like Bhutan. It's not the Shangri-La that it's too often easy to think of, a country which celebrates and, you know, gross national happiness. These changes, beginning with newspapers, but also with mobiles and social media, they're actually making a difference.
Yes. What I found so interesting going back there again and again is that before newspapers arrived, before television arrived, in particular television, there was a lot of talk in the West and concern that it would ruin Bhutan, all this outside influence. But actually what the Bhutanese are doing with all these modern media is they're using it to talk amongst themselves and they're using it to reflect their own culture to each other. And before mobile phones and things, if you're talking about remote farmers, they would see other farmers once a year at the annual Seshu, the festival. Now they have a media space where they find about history, about their leaders, about their culture. So it's created a really vibrant space where they're talking and they're animated and they're criticising and showcasing all things that are important to them.
Bunty Averson is the author of The Dragon's Voice, How Modern Media Found Bhutan.
Just over a week ago, it was announced that ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, would cease all shortwave broadcasts from its external service, Radio Australia. Many people have been criticising this move. The former head of Radio Australia and subsequently a consultant on international broadcasting in the Pacific, Jean-Graeb Monguet, told Bruce Hill the decision is short-sighted.
Shortwave, as we know, has been certainly Radio Australia's, the ABC's, historic way to reach audiences far away, and in particular in the Asia-Pacific region. For a number of years, it has been discussed and suggested that that was on its way out. When I was at Radio Australia in the late 90s, we were faced with the reality of the cessation of shortwave broadcasting to Asia. However, it was maintained to the Pacific. And the argument there was that to maintain it, it was essential to reach people in remote areas and in countries which are developing countries and who don't necessarily have already access to new modes of transmission. Now, At Radio Australia, I know I was part of a team who put in place a whole network of rebroadcasts of FM transmitters in Asia and the Pacific, because we knew that in some places shortwave wasn't effective anymore. The point here is that you cannot do one without the other. I know the ABC is making the point that we want to make our content available on a range of platforms. Yes, let's do it, but let's not do it at the cost of particular platforms which are still very effective in certain regions. And I would argue that in the Pacific, shortwave is still a very relevant delivery platform.
Why is it still relevant in the Pacific? Because everywhere else in the world, everything's online, it's on the internet, it's on FM, it can get it anywhere. Why is shortwave still necessary in the Pacific, do you think?
Because most of the people in the Pacific live in rural areas, and most of them still do not have access to the internet, still do not have access to FM broadcasts, still do not have access to mobile telephony. It's very nice to say that people will listen to FM radio on their telephone. Well, no, they won't, because certainly telephony has made a big progress in the Pacific. But people, battery time on your mobile phone is something that's not affordable for everybody in the region. People are really cautious at the way they use their telephones, and as I said, FM isn't always available. So it may be true for urban centres, but certainly not in rural areas, and therefore for most of the people.
And what about in emergency situations such as cyclones, when, say, FM transmitters are often the first to blow over?
Well, that's right, yes. I mean, and that's why there is still a case for that that kind of service. Now, I can see the attraction for an ABC management which is strapped for funds, which is squeezed by very hostile conservative governments, to look around and look for money, and hey, here is another little pot of money that we hadn't touched so far to use that. But listen, I think it's basically another knife in the back of Radio Australia, the much maligned Radio Australia.
Could there be any positives to this? Is moving to other platforms challenging the ABC and Radio Australia to do more for overseas people in different ways using different platforms?
Well, I think the onus is on the ABC and on ABC managers in charge of international to develop those other platforms sufficiently and to such a stage that then you can consider stopping shortwave broadcasting. But listen, so far, it is not my experience going into the Pacific that the FM relays that have been put in place have been maintained adequately. It is not my experience that ABC programs are being rebroadcast on local stations, which is a key delivery platform to reach audiences there, much more than our own FM services. Until they have developed those platforms sufficiently, they shouldn't be considering stopping shortwave broadcasting.
How do you think this will be received in the Pacific?
Well, I don't know, Bruce, because I think the ABC has lost a lot of listeners. With due respect to your excellent work and of your few colleagues who are left, I don't know that people will even realise that's going on. And that's the other issue. People in Australia, the Australian public, do not realise what has been the damage that has been caused to the ABC's international operation through neglect on one hand and very poor management on the other.
The former head of Radio Australia and consultant on international broadcasting in the Pacific, Jean Gabriel Monquet, speaking to Bruce Hill about the short-sighted cuts to Radio Australia. And with that's all we have time for. We'll see you again next week. So long, and take care. Bye-bye.